your future children, would you instill them with the skills necessary to use chopsticks?
I think I might try to find an external, like a private chopsticks teacher for them.
I think that's a brilliant idea. It's a niche that someone really needs to capitalize on. Hello, welcome, just us again. I'm Matt Patches, and I'm super serious because we've got a seriously fun, serious episode of the Super Serious Sophisticates. With me, as always, the seriousist of serious people, Rajan Mudambi. Taking things seriously, I hope. Yes, good.
For sure.
Good. And in the far reaches of Serious Town, USA, Ryan Pfister. Bringing that serious A game. So let's get down to serious business because we've seriously got three serious topics to seriously cover. Topic number one, the obligation to use chopsticks.
So the issue here, as I think is common for just about anyone who has eaten at a Chinese restaurant, is that you are presented with chopsticks. And you are often also presented with silverware. And the question is whether you should use the silverware or use the chopsticks, and whether you have an obligation socially to use one or the other. I personally can go both ways on it because I am capable of using the chopsticks, but just not very effectively.
Well, why do you think you're capable of using chopsticks, since I'm assuming growing up you were not using chopsticks on a regular basis, like with family meals?
Test. Whether I can, because I can use the chopstick to eventually get the food into my mouth.
But how did you even learn to use them? That's my question to you.
I don't know, a generous Asian friend or two, perhaps?
Someone gave you the time of day to teach you the cultural necessities to be able to use chopsticks.
Yeah, or I don't know. Maybe I watch it on YouTube or something.
No way. You definitely learned to use chopsticks before the existence of YouTube.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
But my question is, like, if it's, you know, for my parents, too, like, I know that my mom does not like to use chopsticks. She'll swap out and use a fork because it's easier. But, like, why do people, I mean, why is it even a problem? Like, shouldn't we be learning to use everything? I mean, it seems like ignorant American a little bit.
I think it's just hard to get good at it. I mean, I draw a parallel here to, like, European countries where if you go in, like, some French people are happy that you're trying to speak French and some people get offended that your French is so bad.
Oh, so you should not even – you shouldn't out yourself as an ignorant American. You should just say, give me the fork. I'm not even going to embarrass myself.
Yeah, I don't know. I could go either way on it.
But, like, it seems – you need to put yourself out there. You need to try. To show that you care.
Because, I mean, I tend to use chopsticks, but I think that's more of just like a pride thing because I'm like, I know how to do this, so I'm going to do it.
You're showing off. But, you're a show-off.
Yeah, obviously. but the thing is, at the end of the day, you're just eating food, so it shouldn't really matter that it's Chinese food or Thai food or French food. Like, why should you need to use a different utensil to eat it?
I think that's narrow-minded. I think you're not including the cultural ramifications of your actions here. You're consuming. I'm going to reference an older episode of The Sophisticates about taste, where you're just consuming for consuming's sake, but you're forgetting that you're in someone else's house when you're consuming this food.
Well, okay. At the same time, why do people not eat with their hands when they go to an Indian restaurant?
Well, why don't they?
Okay. But I think it's kind of equivalent.
I absolutely agree with you. I mean, if there's a cultural practice, but the thing is, does the Indian restaurant instill that upon you? Or have they given up?
Well, they can't exactly give you your hands. You already have them.
Yeah, but they could not put out utensils.
But they usually put out utensils that...
I feel like the cultural institutions here are caving in favor of... economic prosperity, but they shouldn't. They shouldn't have to. We should be better than that.
What do you mean?
Well,
by
I think
that?
The question. I mean, what's the question here? Like, it's are these cultural institutions? Is the core element of that cultural institution the utensil which you use to consume it? Is that an essential element?
I think it's an aspect of it. Yes, I think it's a defining part of eating in a different atmosphere. And embracing that culture, you're giving the cold shoulder. You're saying that, you know, do it my way or get out. And so these restaurants cater to people who don't want to expand their horizons. So by taking by not using the chopsticks, you're stating that you are above it, that you're above their culture.
No, I think you can go.
You can look at it two different ways. You could say that this is a restaurant that is supposed to be giving you the authentic, like, Asian experience of eating food, and then perhaps you should use the chopsticks. Or you could just say, I happen to like this food, but I'm not interested in having a cultural experience. And then why not use fork?
It's not about having a cultural experience. It's about, you know, you're treating it like you're going to a theme park or something, that you're on vacation whenever you go to a Chinese, Japanese, any other kind of restaurant. You're not. You're basically visiting someone else's house, so do it their way.
What if you wanted to create a restaurant here that was intended for offering Chinese food without Chinese cultural expectations? Like, how would you change that from a typical Chinese restaurant? I feel like they've already set that expectation.
Wait, if you want to drop the cultural baggage from a Chinese restaurant? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, like, well...
Then you go to a food court at a mall.
Okay.
Then you go to the teriyaki joint.
But the food quality may not be as good then.
Yeah, well, exactly. So this Chinese restaurant is stepping up their game by delivering you quality food in the manner that they would if they were in their homes, you know, for instance. So then you should respect them. It's a respect thing, don't you think?
Right. Well, I mean, then I go back to my original point that is it more respectful to them to attempt the chopsticks even if you are not good at them?
And embarrass yourself and embarrass them in turn.
Sometimes if you're not good with chopsticks, it can just make the eating experience much less enjoyable. Because you just can't get the food into your mouth. So I mean, I think I'm pretty decent at eating chopsticks, especially if it's like noodles or something. But rice is hard to get sometimes.
But that's because you haven't tried hard enough. You're not.
I actually find it really ironic with rice. You know, like, I feel like rice is one of the least suited foods for a chopstick.
Well, not when it's like sticky rice. The sticky rice.
Yeah, sticky.
Should come in clumps, and you should be able to pick it up with chopsticks. I mean, they've been doing it since, you know, before forks and spoons were invented. So it seems like this is the most basic tool you could possibly use. So there's really a problem with us not being able to use chopsticks. Like, it's the easiest. It should be the easiest thing to do.
There's another kind of thing to look at it as well. Is in general, just the chopsticks are probably the most visible or obvious example of this, but in general, just the manners, like table manners and stuff, don't translate cross-culturally often. So, like, if you watch Asian people eating with chopsticks and stuff, they frequently, like, bring their bowl all the way up to their mouth mm-hmm. and just, like, shovel it in with the chopsticks. But that's incredibly impolite in Western culture, right? So, as a Western person, you kind of feel like you can't do that, but at the same time, that negates a lot of the utilage of those of chopsticks. So as Westerners eating with chopsticks, we're kind of getting the worst of both worlds. We're not able to lift the bowl up to our mouth to make it easier to use the chopsticks, and we're also not allowed to use the fork, which is easier to use than chopsticks if you don't lift up the plate. So, you know, like, I feel like you have to take all of it or you take none of it.
I mean, I tend to agree with that. I think we're kind of in a pickle here, that we either have to stick to our guns or really people have to branch out and be culturally diverse and in their manners or what they have, their definition of manners. And for me, I side on that. Like, I think more people should expand and learn how different cultures eat and the manners that they do so, and that they should really learn to do that. I think it's important to be a worldly person. But from the sound of, like, Fister, what you're saying, it's like, you know what? I'm this guy. I'm coming to a restaurant. I'm doing it the way I want.
No, I don't think I'm saying that. I'm trying to figure out how I can eat in this restaurant and not offend anyone while doing it. But it sounds like the safest course. It sounds like we should go all out, be willing to take the, you know, pick the bowl up and put it next to your face and stuff.
I agree. You need to go to the YouTube. You got to watch some lessons. You got to get some chopstick lessons. People need to be practicing at home. There needs to be research here. You can't just show up to a Chinese restaurant. You need to do your research.
The, The problem there is that, you know, table manners, the point of them is to not offend the people around you. And that includes the people you're eating with. And if the people you're eating with expect Western table manners, they may be offended if you start lifting up the plate to your face.
But that's them being narrow-minded. That's not your fault.
You should just take a look before you eat.
So what are you going to do the next time you go to a Chinese restaurant? I mean, do you have a prerogative now to go and learn, like, to master chopsticks? Or are you still going to kind of just wing it?
Like, I think that I have mastered enough of the chopstick to eventually consume the food. There's still a lot of dropping back into the plate along the way, but the meal does get finished.
Would you ever teach your kids to do that? Your future children? Would you instill them with the skills necessary to use chopsticks?
I think I might try to find an external, like a private chopsticks teacher for them.
I think that's a brilliant idea. It's a niche that someone really needs to capitalize on. That could be gold. That's money in the bank. Although I'm gonna just stick with the Indian route and eat with my hands.
Okay.
Those are built in.
It'd be a nice cultural hybrid right there. Chinese food, but you eat it with your hands.
Everything with my hands. Well, on that note, why don't we move on to our second topic for today? Pre-writing obituaries. So this is a topic that's been brewing in the background of this podcast for quite a while, but it came to my mind again after the unfortunate death of Whitney Houston. Did you guys hear about that? I'm hoping it was on your radar.
It was kind of difficult to
Sorry,
miss.
I'm breaking
what?
The news
Wait,
to you.
Whitney's dead?
Whitney Houston is dead. But, you know, as soon as it happened, and thanks to the wonders of things like Twitter, which is how, and this might sound sad, but it's how I get a lot of my news because it's immediate. It happens right away. I know exactly when she died and everyone puts it on Twitter and blah. But immediately after that announcement, you know, New York Times, AP, they all have their obituaries up, which I think is incredible. Like, obviously there are people hired, you know, I just watched this amazing documentary called Page 8. Which is, I think it's on Netflix Instant Watch, if any of you want to watch it, but it's about a look behind the New York Times, them struggling to stay relevant, being a print institution and going into the digital world. They let their obituary writer go. She'd been working there for like 30 years, but that's her job. She writes obituaries for people who eventually are going to die and they're going to have to run them immediately. They want to be the first people to get the obituary out and they want to do it right. I think that makes perfect sense. You want something well-written. You want something well-chronicled. On the other hand, I find it weird, like, that they immediately have something. Like, this person has died, and they immediately have this detailed, biographical 3 pages on this person's life. It just feels so sudden. And I wonder if that's kind of a silly feeling to have about obituaries. Just, it just happened, and now, you know, here's their life, and I'm paying homage to them and in the wake of their death. It just happened. That's crazy.
Well, I mean, obviously, as alluded to in the title, like, clearly this can only happen if you've written the obituary before they're dead.
Well, I think that happens for most major publications.
For most famous people in these major publications, they just have an obit sitting there on file. So, Patches, obviously, the New York Times has an obit for you right now.
They better. I could die anytime, and they have to have all my important milestones.
Yeah,
this
exactly.
podcast, for instance.
Exactly. But how would that make you feel, that they're just prepared for you to be dead?
Well, that's the thing. It makes me feel like this person is just a news story to them. Like, it's not, it doesn't feel heartfelt. I know it's not supposed to be necessarily, but I mean, you're the New York Times paying respect to, in this case, Whitney Houston, who's this amazing entertainment performer, and you want to pay respect, so it seems like you need a window of time to at least make it seem like you spent time crafting it. You know what I mean? When it comes out right away, it seems like it was generated by a computer or something. It's so quick. It doesn't have the same, you need the moment, the breath, the gravity of the situation to hit you, and then something well-written can come out about it, something that's respectful. This is breaking the news. You can break the news in 2 sentences, you know. You can do a little, you know, written piece about how she died or whatever. But, like, obituaries feel like the emotional way we deal with an important person's death. And to do it suddenly doesn't feel emotional. But maybe I'm too emotional about it.
Well, I mean, I think that's a good point. I think it depends on kind of what you look at the obituary at. I mean, is it simply a biography of that person's life?
Right. That's why I have Wikipedia now. Wikipedia does that.
Yeah. I mean, that is what we use Wikipedia for.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we should do the rethinking the obituary in the age of Wikipedia.
I never really thought about it until I exclaimed Wikipedia just now. But it seems like obituaries, the way they used to be written, are kind of defunct now that we have, like, up-to-the-minute biographical, you know, these long entries on people's lives. I mean, you don't need to be the first obituary. You need to be the heartfelt obituary that gets, like, quotes from people who care and that sort of thing. It seems so silly to be first out the gate with that stuff.
We are also in a society where being first counts for something.
True, true. I think we've talked a little bit about that before. Just like the important, you know, they want to be the first person with an obituary for Whitney Houston. Totally, I get that. But even if you're trying to be first at the top of Google, you can just do that with a news story about her death. You don't need an obituary.
Obituaries for me, I used to edit them actually at a summer internship, and it's funny because I think sometimes you'll even hear about obituaries as a goal writing exercise, where you basically use the obituary as the defining form for your life, and I just think it's funny when you have somebody that has become famous. It's like the obituary has it congealed their life too much, you know, at that point. It's like, if you read your own obituary, would you think you were done with your life?
Right. No, I think that's the thing. It's like it's not predestining your death, obviously, because you're going to die at some point, but it's weird to have it all surmised in a condensed, like, perfectly constructed, like, an obituary. The way they run them now is too well done. It's too constructed. It's too scientific. You know, Rajan, you sent us this crazy, crazy obituary for this guy, John Fairfax, who died recently. And he's well known for rowing across the Atlantic Ocean. First guy to row across the Atlantic Ocean. And his obituary is just this, like, insane list of, you know, other little tidbits about what he did. You know, he at 9, he settled a dispute with a pistol. At age 20, he almost committed suicide by jaguar. Just like all these random little things. And it feels like a Wikipedia page at this point, but it doesn't really tell us about him or about what, I don't know, it doesn't define him. It's like a list of facts that feel perfectly assembled. And that's not, to me, like, that's not the way I would want my death reported.
You also have to kind of think about it this way, because the obituary is going out to the world, to people who probably don't know you. They may have heard of you, they may know something about you, but they don't know you. And so it's when you're trying to commemorate or memorialize someone that people don't actually know, it's hard to really, sometimes it's hard to connect to them on an emotional level, because with someone like a singer or an actor or something, our emotional connection with them is not going to be related necessarily to something specific that they did, but it'll be more to an association with having heard them sing or having watched a movie with them in it that has really resonated with you. And that's not something that you can kind of, like, it's not going to be the same for all the people who read it. And so you can't really speak to that aspect of it in a, like, mass, in an obituary that's supposed to be to reach, you know, the whole world.
Right. So, it, so I mean, I, it I, is, I'm it's a sure news that, story. At the end of the day, an obituary is a news story.
It really is. Because if you think about, like, I mean, the obituary is kind of a eulogy. Like, it's a analogous to, like, a eulogy at a funeral, right? But the difference is, a eulogy at a funeral, most of the people at the funeral presumably know the person, right? And so you can kind of speak to actual things in their life that they've done, or how you've, like, connected with them on a level, on some level, and other people out there may have connected in that exact same way. And that, you know, can strike a chord. But if you're just writing about Oh, but maybe it should be written in that way. Like as a writer, or as a person, not as a writer. The writer connected with Whitney Houston because they were singing this, hearing this song or whatever. Maybe they should write like that.
Well,
and that might connect to more people than.
To kind of wrap up, Pfister, you know, I know you come from a background in journalism. Should an obituary just be another piece of news, or does it defy like every other kind of story that runs in a newspaper or online or something?
Well, I think it's definitely its own type. I think it's different from just, I mean, because you're conveying historical information, you know.
But I mean, a lot of news stories do that as their foundation for whatever the breaking news is. You know, you want to cover it with foundation, the background of whatever's happening.
I think the thing though is often obituaries are separate from if somebody's new death by itself is particularly newsworthy. You know, often you'll even have a separate story about that. I mean, the obituary is where the death is just kind of the news peg. You know, it's the reason you're writing about it, but what the person did in life is the important part.
Because we wouldn't be writing this obituary about them if they hadn't done something significant.
Well, thank God I have, because I want to make sure that my obituary is really good. One of you should write it, probably.
That's you should.
Oh, I already have.
On it now. Yeah, we should start collaborating now.
You could,
just so we're ready.
Yeah, I want all three of us to have solid obituaries when we're dead, probably soon. Anyway,
would you like us to post it on the Sophisticated blog?
Yes, we'll post my obituary soon on Tumblr, where it was meant to be seen, on social media blogs. Oh God, that's probably the future. If anything, Tumblr obits.
Actually, that is what my grandfather recently died. Actually, and my parents and aunts and uncles were very upset that the obituary was so expensive to run in the paper. So my uncle suggested that when he dies, we should just tweet.
I mean, that seems totally reasonable. More people can share it. I will like that on Facebook whenever it gets posted.
That somebody died?
Well, I mean, I'll like their obit. I will share it on, I don't know. But that's the way of the future. You know it is. You laugh, but like... Someone's gonna write their or someone's gonna post an obituary for someone else, and there's gonna be like 43 likes. I don't know. Way of the future. Way of the future. Speaking of the way of the future, why don't we move on to today's third topic, the future of dirty jobs. So recently, I was actually browsing Facebook to go back to that goddamn piece of machinery. And stumbled upon this video that a friend had shared of Mike Rowe, host of this TV show called Dirty Jobs, where he basically goes and interviews, explores these jobs that people do that are just, you know, they're kind of like blue-collar jobs and down and dirty, like cutting down trees or shoveling shit or all sorts of things. And, you know, he's really taken a stance of recent, and I think he was testifying in front of Washington State Congress or something about the need to expose our academic inflation in this country, which I find a really interesting topic because I think everybody is pressured, at least I was, not pressured is the wrong word, but told that they should go to college and study and get a great job someday. And what Mike Rowe is really worried about is that we're forgetting that we really need these quote-unquote blue-collar jobs for society to exist. Like, there need to be plumbers here. There need to be, you know, construction workers. There need to be these guys who just get down and dirty and do these things that help us survive. And his worry is that we're just teaching everyone not to do these jobs as if there's some sort of stigma about taking those jobs. They're lesser jobs. And I'm wondering if you guys feel that same way. You know, we all grew up pushed to do well academically, go to college. We all did that. That's exactly the path that we were on. And we're not plumbers. Are you worried that we're not plumbers?
On some level, yeah. Because the goal of, you know, parents in general is that their kid has a better life, whatever that means, than they did, for the most part. And so, and that generally means, you know, they should do well in school and then go to college. And once they get out of college, you know, it's going to be this amazing job for them that's going to be better than the job that I have, right? I think that it's not always true, because at the end of the day, I mean, society is changing to more of an information-based sort of economy and everything, where knowledge and stuff and, like, you know, electronic transmitted information and stuff is much more important than it used to be. But we don't live on the internet. I mean, maybe we think we do, but at the end of the day, we do need to have people fix our wiring and install our cable and fix our pipes and stuff. And somebody's got to do it. But nobody, yeah, like you said, everyone wants to go to college so that they don't have to do
that. Right. I don't know how we get back to that. I don't really know how we de-incentivize education and pushing people to get... I mean, how do you say, no, why don't you just stick to being a contractor?
Well, I think that a lot of the problem is the cultural stigma that we put on these jobs. Because I am sensitive to the other side of this argument as well, which is, I mean, yeah, everybody agrees that, okay, we should put these, you know, make sure that people go to a job that, you know, they can actually do in the end and that will pay, as opposed to just going to college even if they didn't really want to go. But I think we also have to be careful that we don't take people that might have wanted to go to college but were just kind of unlikely candidates for it and force them into trade school instead.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you don't know what kind of potential somebody could have.
Right. And I think that's why the emphasis on going to college and getting a degree and, like, doing great things has been such a push. I mean, because that's on that side, you don't want to miss out on someone who could do great things by having an education. But
agreed.
Then how do
and
you?
I think that's important. Yeah, it's terrible when somebody slips through the cracks that could have done great things and got an education and everything. But at the same time, it's also bad when you build up these expectations for people that they can go to college, and when they do, they come out and they're going to have a great job waiting for them, and there just isn't a job waiting. I think that not to get too like political about it and everything, but I do think that is a part of what the discontent for people right now is that, sure, the economy is kind of bad, sort of, but part of it is also there are too many people who want these kind of white-collar jobs that in the past wouldn't have been looking for white-collar jobs, and the quantity of the jobs hasn't necessarily increased enough to accommodate all these people. And so people come out of college and they expect that there's going to be this job waiting for them when there isn't.
Right. I think about, you know, we all went to high school together. Do you think that there's something instilled upon us, like, when we're at that level to kind of, besides, hey, go to college? I mean, how would our growing up change to be able to make it okay? Like, why didn't I consider just settling down and being like a construction worker? Why? I don't understand why that wasn't it. Option in my mind.
Well, I mean, it sort of was an option. We had the tech school.
No, we did. That we definitely did. But for some reason, it was not something that I'm like, well, that's just, I'm, maybe it's because I just didn't have an interest in how those things worked. Like, do people, you know, there are people who are interested in engineering and how these, the do-it-yourself kind of attitude. And that wasn't something that I possessed. But I think there are people like that. But I don't know if there's someone pushing those people to do well at that, to be good and really understand it.
I think that what we, like, as a society, we need to try to equalize all these different paths.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think that if you honestly think that you want to, that you would enjoy being a plumber or a car mechanic or something like that, that's fine, and you should go for it. You shouldn't feel like you're settling by doing that instead of going to college. Because I think in many cases, somebody who is in a trade like that, especially if they're good at it, they can make more money than a college graduate.
Yeah, and I don't think they make that apparent to many people. Like, I know we had the trade school, but that was such a distant – Like, I don't feel like I was ever introduced to the concept of trade school, even though it existed in our program in high school. Do you feel that way?
I feel that...
Did anyone sit you down and, like, you can go there?
No, no one did. I feel like, I guess I kind of knew that there was... Actually, I don't even know if I did know there was one.
I knew that there were some kids who got on a bus every day and went there and then came back.
It was never on my radar in any way.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think, I don't know, because, like, we were, like, in Richmond and stuff, and so maybe...
Yeah, we were douchebags.
Because of that, they just kind of assumed that it was not something that was relevant to us, maybe. I don't know.
Which I think is wrong, especially, like, oh, we're in Richmond, so just to clarify, we weren't smarter. We were thinking differently. I just want to say that. We were definitely not smarter than anyone else. But it seems like those people, especially, you may want to offer the chance to go to trade school to get to, like, to think differently in that capacity. And for some reason, like, the honors classes aren't pushing you to go to trade school. It's like college, SATs, AP classes.
The thing is, if you're the sort of person who likes building things and working with their hands and would be a good car mechanic, you'd also probably be a good mechanical engineer. And, you know, and that's got more cachet, and it requires going to college.
Right. But then you would never go back to being a car mechanic.
No.
And you would probably not find a job, because all the engineers I currently know are struggling to find jobs.
I mean, yeah. I think there's probably a higher demand for car mechanics. But I mean, there is demand for mechanical engineers, and everyone thinks that they're going to be the one who's going to get the job anyway. It reminds me of something in My Fair Lady / Pygmalion, whatever, where basically... Henry Higgins teaches Eliza Doolittle how to speak well, and, like, introduces her to this high society and everything. But he's under the impression that he can just, like, do this and then just send her back to selling flowers, and that's going to be fine. But his mother kind of tells him, no, that's not going to be okay, because, like, once you've been exposed to all of this new world that you didn't really know existed, you can't go back. And I think going to college is like that.
So do you think there are a lot of people who go to college who probably should have been put on a different path, or at least given a chance to be on that different path? Like,
I do think there are a lot of people who go to college who probably shouldn't have gone to college, and that sounds horrible to say, but I do think that's true.
There's a lot of people who go to college without any idea what they want to do, and then they continue to do that, and they never give another thought to the possibility of not going to college.
Yeah. I think a lot of people go to college just because that's what you're supposed to do.
Right.
Not because they have something that they want to do with going to college.
Well, I mean, did you know what you wanted to do when you went into college?
No, of course I didn't.
Cool. That's why I say that I don't know
that I know that there's a solution necessarily. But I do think that there are a lot of jobs that are out there that basically you can't get the job unless you have a college degree, where there's absolutely no need for you to have a college degree to do that job.
Right.
Just because there are so many people who are now going to college that they just feel, well, why not?
They're trying to weed people out. Yeah.
Yeah. And so now basically you spent 4 years going to college, getting really no practical training for what you want to do, but you have to go because otherwise you won't be able to get this job.
They're de-emphasizing people's actual skills and putting the focus on something that's on paper that actually means nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think that at the end of the day, there is... I can't blame anybody who goes to college, and I can't blame anybody for what path they end up on. I do have a problem with the way people nurture those people. And I think that there is an issue with people having goals for young people and trying to put them on a path instead of actually recognizing those people's abilities and helping nurture that. And I think at the end of the day, that's the problem. And when you go to high school, it's such this sprawling sea of different types of people and personalities. It's hard for people to help mentor you and push you in the right direction without taking your background and trying to utilize that and make sense of that and put you in a certain place. And, you know, it's just about someone helping you find your set of skills. And that does not exist.
I mean, I think it's an expectations game that we have to play. Like, I think that you know, if you want to go to college, go to college, but don't expect that there's going to be a job waiting at the end. I mean, understand that going to college is a little bit more of a circuitous route to get to a job at the end.
Keep practicing your woodworking. I think that's the important part here.
I mean, going to college is great, and I'm very glad I did, but it's not a cure-all. Life is not just going to automatically become, you know, perfect because you went to college. You're not going to automatically have a job, and, you know? It often can help, but it's not, you know, just at the end of the day, it's not a panacea.
Recognize your skills. People got them. They just need to follow their hearts. I would say, to be poetic about it. Well, on that note, that is an expansive topic that I'm sure we could go days talking about. But we will wrap up there and get on to a more important topic, Ryan Pfister's haircut.
Oh, this is – I think it's today. Today is going to be the day.
You're
to do
actually
it.
Getting a haircut as – like right after we speak.
As we speak. In the barbershop.
Like, I am in the barbershop right now.
Someday we're going to have to do an episode live from our barbershop as you get your haircut to be kind of in the moment. So you're at maximum hair capacity right now. It's time to go.
I remember I have a Facebook photo of where I did not get a haircut at this point previously, and it was bad news from here on.
Remind me to post pictures of you in different stages of hair on our Tumblr at some point, just so people finally get a visual representation of what we're talking about. Anyway, that is today's episode of The Sophisticates. Thank you very much for listening. You know where you can find us. We're on Twitter at Sophisticast with a PH. Don't forget. We're at Tumblr, thesophisticates.tumblr.com. We're on iTunes. You should subscribe or double check that you are subscribed, because I think after a prolonged absence, those things tend to like shut off automatically. So resubscribe if you have previously subscribed on iTunes. And go leave us notes and reviews and help us make the show really good. So we will talk to you later, and stay serious.